third speaker and the first of our second half, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Steve Crocker. He's an associate professor of sociology at Memorial University, and he studies social and political thought and social and political philosophy. He teaches courses in social theory, media studies, globalization, and Newfoundland society. And, excitingly, he's organizing an event in September on Muskrat Falls in St. John's, and he's looking for people who are doing scholarly research on the topic, so more information will be coming from Steve soon. But Steve, thank you for joining us in Labrador. It gives us great pleasure to have you here.
Hi everyone, thank you very much to Ashley and to Sean and to everybody in Labrador who has made this event possible. Really glad that it's happening. We are organizing an event in St. John's in September, in late September, as Ashley mentioned, for people who are doing research, scholarly research, but any kind of research really that is related to Muskrat Falls or that could help us to understand Muskrat Falls. So I will disseminate more information about that to Ashley and probably to the list if there is one available. I'll turn on to talking about Muskrat Falls. I'll just say a few prefatory comments, and then I'm going to read a paper that I've been writing about Muskrat Falls. That will be less than 3 minutes. Just say a couple of words to lead into it. In sociology, it's a common premise that we learn more about the operation of the social world when social institutions don't work in the way we had expected, when social institutions break down or don't perform in the way that we had imagined that they would, then there are opportunities to do research and to see how is the social world put together in the first place. How do we find linkages between changes in, for example, social policy, political organization, democracy, finance, changes in environment, and so on. In the project and the scale of Muskrat Falls, any one of those dimensions is so enormously complex that it leads you down its own wormhole of figuring out the financial transaction chains that link together loan conditions and rate payments, or figuring out how bacteria methylate mercury and how changes in the mercury cycle affect the production of methylmercury in dams is so incredibly complex and another wormhole. It's very difficult to understand the linkages between these complex phenomena because each of those is so complex. One of the things that I think that sociology can do or tries to do is to understand those kinds of linkages. How does finance, public policy, environment, etc. link together to form a social whole, a totality that changes the kind of society that we live in? So that's what's happening in Muskrat Falls, I think, that it is something on the scale of the changes in all of those linkages of how we think about what counts as economy, environment, public policy, etc. So trying to draw those together, I think Muskrat Falls is part of a bigger change that's happening around the world in which states are making access to basic conditions of life more dependent upon complex, volatile market forces that make it much more difficult for people to establish basic conditions of security, energy security, food security, physical security, etc. It's happening here, it's happening all over the world, in systematic ways, using techniques that are the same in many different places, in many different contexts, that have a similar result of displacing citizens' access to basic resources in order to facilitate the flow of funds to investors, banks, and to satisfy loan conditions and guarantees. So, with those preparatory comments, I'll try to now go through some points about the structure of finance of Muskrat Falls and the nature of compensation for methylmercury as it's being discussed so far. I'll just read the paper. So, Muskrat Falls was initially proposed as a way to provide a reliable source of clean energy and a constant stream of revenue for the province into the 21st century. The massive scale of this project, almost four times more than the province would likely need to meet its future energy requirements, was justified by the prospect of selling excess energy over the maritime link to Nova Scotia and on the American on-the-spot market. Long-term revenue from external sales would eventually cover the short-term mega-cost of its construction. In this way, it promised a unity of financial and energy security. Now that it is 90% completed, however, not even the CEO of the corporation running it believes it will ever provide cheap electricity or reliable revenue. It has already absorbed all of our oil money. Its unfathomable debt has claimed our financial future. It is widely acknowledged that it will double electricity rates on the island, which is another way of saying that it will cut in half the energy security of many, and it will destroy the well-being and livelihood of people on the Churchill River, forcing them to substitute for available, nutritional, wild food, unreliable and inaccessibly priced flown-in market goods. By all accounts, Muskrat Falls is a terrible failure that will make us poorer, colder, hungrier, and sicker. It will present significant obstacles to security, energy security on the island, and to food security in Labrador. And yet, we are to understand that now that it has begun, Frankenstein must be finished. It must be paid for, it must be brought into stream, and we must bear the consequences, financial and fiscal. Muskrat Falls illustrates some of the absurdity of modern economics, that development and growth can be tied to deterioration in the standard of living, and that an increase in the GDP can mean a decrease in access to basic conditions of livability and greater exposure to harm. In the threat it poses to energy security on the island and food and physical security in Labrador, we see how changes in the political economy of the state are making people more dependent on volatile market forces at the same time that it ensures that in this volatility, it is business and investors who are first protected from contingencies and risks that they themselves provoke and exploit. Muskrat Falls is part of a more general reorganization of the state that is taking place in many parts of the world and subordinating the living conditions of citizens to the demands of speculative finance and loan conditions. In the little time I have here, I'll point out some ways, I don't mean the little time I have here on this earth, but just here now, I'll point out some of the ways that financialization of our energy security is being linked to wider changes that reorganize the state as a business, that reconceive the citizen as an investor, and that reconceive our collective resources as assets that are best used to leverage capital markets and credit rather than to provide immediate relief for citizens. Along with these changes, it creates a new kind of social sorting that accepts that some parts of our society will drop out of the social safety net and will now form an acceptable level of collateral damage that is the unfortunate condition of keeping market climate and payment schedules stable. In short, our understanding of the state's social responsibility is being changed through projects like this, from a mandate to provide public infrastructure and secure conditions of life, to securing instead access to more volatile and unreliable market forces, and changing democratic legislation to make populations more responsible to the needs of investors and markets. These developments connect nameless global financial forces to the most immediate and intimate dimensions of our lives, the comfort of our homes, the breast milk fed to children, the blood-brain barrier. As we try to deconstruct the 100,000 documents of Muskrat Falls, someone recently said that the inquiry will at least read that many, it is easy to get lost in the local actions and scandals of the figures who brought it into being here. But it is important to recognize that many of the devices used to financialize our energy security are in common use around the world and reorganizing social life in similarly undesirable ways, from Kenya to Mexico and Newfoundland to Nicaragua. The failure of Muskrat Falls offers an opportunity to understand some of these transaction chains, as sociologists call them, that link new and low-level forms of discomfort and brutality to complex financial machinations. These are some of the things that are at stake in the sociology of Muskrat Falls. I would like to now say a few words in particular about some of the ways that financing and compensation work in this project to produce insecurity for citizens. Financing. Muskrat Falls threatens our energy security on the island, not only because it is big or mismanaged, but more precisely because the entire cost of the financing and construction of the massive capacity for non-existent or unreliable external markets has to be collected solely through rates paid by electrical consumers on the island. That is the condition imposed by the federal government on the loan guarantees provided to lenders who provide capital for the project. These onerous conditions give some indication of the high-risk nature of the capital venture in which citizens of this province are all now investors. The conditions were imposed because, by Nalcor's own admission, revenue from the external sale of excess energy, the only thing that justified the size of the dam and the attendant problems, revenue from external sales of excess energy is so unreliable a source that no private or public institution has enough confidence in it to justify a loan on the basis of its business plan. The fact is that no one would agree to purchase Muskrat Power, which proved to most that it was an unfeasible project. The only financial recourse was then the loan guarantee, which required that the entire cost of the dam be recovered from charges for domestic supply to Newfoundland's electrical customers. Now, that is because, as comical as it may seem, when the project had been subjected to the highest levels of financial scrutiny, the only actual reliable future source of revenue on which a schedule of loan payments could be based was the predictable regularity of us paying our electrical bills. In many ways, it was not the river, but the ratepayers of the island who were, in effect, the basic economic resource, the primitive accumulation that was harnessed as collateral for a colossal loan to build a business that no one in the business world believed would ever work. What was used here was exactly the same financial technique that is used in the subprime mortgage crisis in the United States, in which the sale of debt payments is used to leverage loans, and in that way imperil consumers' access to the goods for which those payments provided access. Homes in Detroit, electricity in Newfoundland. Loan guarantees like this function as important devices that translate global financial power into public policy and that rearrange social life to serve the interests of capital markets. That is true not just here. All over the world, the loan guarantee has been a central device through which the social structure of nations is adjusted to the demands of world markets. Through structural adjustment programs, austerity measures that force developing nations to abandon social security in order to secure loan payments for investors. To meet these conditions, the state has to reimagine whatever sources of security its population and its territory possess as an asset that can be leveraged to access venture capital for private public enterprises on which that energy security is now made to depend and is now made vulnerable. In this rearrangement, our collective electrical payments are not primarily a means to stay warm. They are redesigned with a new purpose, as a means to make regular payments on an investment that is entirely extraneous to the energy needs of citizen consumers, and that will not protect the most vulnerable from the worst excesses. We are told that things are now on schedule in Stan Marshall's talk last week, and no more increases will follow. That's great. But the important fact remains that in our new political economy, any future contingencies will not be threats to Nalcor's or MRS plans, but to the well-being of ratepayers on the island who are first obligated to serve those external debts before addressing their own needs. That is how we go from having the lowest rates in the country to having the highest. To meet the loan conditions and to ensure that electrical rates do remain reliable as a source of debt payment, the Dunderdale government introduced two important changes to the Electrical Power Act that are worth considering in a little more detail. The first consolidates Nalcor's monopoly over the circulation of energy, supply, distribution, sale. By preventing any other electrical developments, it ensures that whatever money is spent on electricity on the island is paid to Nalcor, who, remember, are obliged to use those funds first to pay financing of external sales and only then to address our energy needs. One immediate devastating consequence of this is that there can be no commercial development of alternative energy here for most of the 21st century because new sources of energy would be in competition with Nalcor's domestic sale of Muskrat Power. Recently, a visiting researcher from the University of Waterloo, investigating the island's wind energy potential, discovered that alternative energy in this province has now become illegal, as he put it. Secondly, Bill 61 removes authority to review and set consumer electrical rates from the jurisdiction of the Public Utilities Board, a regulatory agency that has some autonomy in representing the public's interest in assessing the cost effectiveness and rate structures of public utilities. The PUB itself was able to consider whether the project serves the public good or whether some other solution might have better served our energy needs. Cabinet will now instead oversee the Muskrat project and set electrical rates in whatever way it finds necessary to continue to cover the entire cost of the Muskrat project, even as it goes massively over budget. Each of these developments is controversial in its own right, but it is important to recognize their combined effect. The loan guarantee, the monopoly provision, the de-democratization of the PUB, the de-democratization, the removal of it as from a democratic institution, the de-democratization of the PUB, they work together to use the full legislative power of the state to ensure that citizens continue to provide reliable sources of debt financing into the future when our economic situation deteriorates and electrical rates increase. And Dave already mentioned the specter of that at the end of his talk. Consider what is at stake here. In this increasingly unpredictable world of global market and environmental forces, we might reasonably look to the state as a device for protecting populations from risks and variation in market volatility and from the physical dangers of natural and manufactured risks, such as climate change or mercury poisoning. According to this view, the state's primary purpose is to provide an infrastructure that, in spite of global fluctuations in market and climate, aims first to ensure conditions of livability, you might call them, such as affordable heat, power, food, shelter, and water for everyone. Muskrat Falls instead promised to let the market do the work of the state and provide energy security. The idea was that greater exposure to bigger markets and riskier ventures makes us better able to weather the storms of climate change, war, or global financial complexity. In the case of Muskrat Falls, though, we see that these changes are never simply financial. They also always involve the reorganization of basic ideas of social security and access to conditions of livability that threaten the existential security, we might call it, of those with lower, little, or no income. In other words, those who need the power of the state most can expect less from it in the future. It has now become even more dangerous to be poor in Newfoundland and Labrador. Now I'd like to turn to say a few words about compensation along the same lines of volatility, security, risk, organization of the state, etc. I wanted to draw some parallels here with the role of volatility and security in the debate on mercury poisoning. I want to draw on some of the ideas here from the American sociologist Saskia Sassan. In her book, Expulsions, Sassan traces what she calls subterranean network, the kind of underground connections one doesn't see, of finance and power that link projects like these to a diverse array of forms of expulsion, she calls it. From the fracking of land to the poisoning of rivers, the formation of stateless populations, the expulsion of people from adjacent natural resources, the dispossession of homes in Detroit and the Rust Belt, they are all united by similar techniques of expulsion that arrange to remove, neutralize, or generally expel from normal social entitlement populations who are determined to be of less value to capital and the state as producers and consumers than the resource to which they are adjacent and may lay some claim. Expulsion does not mean that subject populations are simply placed outside the social order and left on their own to live their own life. Expelled populations of the kind Sassan describes are included in the polis, in the polity, in the society, are included in the polis as a group who is excluded from normal entitlements that others enjoy. So, not free to exist on their own, in their own way of living, but not able fully to participate in the society from which they are being expelled. The poisoning of the Churchill River illustrates many of these points.
From the beginning of the project, it seemed clear that the lives and livelihood of the people who live on the Churchill River did not matter enough, still do not, to deserve to be protected from harm whenever a choice had to be made between stopping the project or endangering the adjacent population. This was true in the joint panel review that Dave mentioned, where methylmercury was raised as a concern, the exclusion of Lake Melville was raised as a concern, it was completely ignored. Now, CORE and the provincial government were never compelled to follow the advice of that joint review panel. When the new Harvard research by the best mercury scientists in the world showed that the Lake Melville area, which now CORE had excluded from its research, was instead exceptionally conducive to methylmercury production, now CORE and the provincial government talked down the significance of the Harvard report. They agreed only to remove some of the vegetation from the reservoir and to increase monitoring in the Lake Melville area. The CEO of the corporation explained that its tightly organized schedule required flooding to begin before freeze-up in the fall, which would be anytime after the middle of October 2016. And though it was already $6 billion over budget at that point, it said that it could not afford the additional $0.5 to $1 billion, which is estimated at that time, to clear the soil. Now, CORE explained that monitoring mercury levels and providing compensation for the inconvenience of poisoning the river was a reasonable and established practice for dealing with the unfortunate reality of mercury pollution. But the new research on Lake Melville showed that the irreversible damage would be immediate. Peak levels would be reached within 72 hours, 1,500 times the amount that Health Canada recommends for human consumption in the regulated area. So monitoring would be of little benefit, because it would happen so quickly. Even for the most hard-headed, it was clear from the research that we do not know enough to know that it is safe to proceed. So even if you didn't believe what they were saying, there was enough in there to believe that we certainly do not know enough to proceed safely. And in spite of that reservation, things continued. I'm just going to be very close here, a couple more minutes here, now that we finished. To ease tension, Premier Dwight Ball then announced that, though the flooding would likely proceed, people should know that they could expect to be compensated if mercury levels did rise to a dangerous level. If people were unable to fish or hunt, they could buy food with compensatory funds. Ball invited the Nunatsiavut government to get to a table, which is phrase, but to get to a table and discuss this, to get to a table and discuss the matter government to government. But the Nunatsiavut government insisted that there was nothing to discuss, there was something to do to clear the reservoir. Note how the organization of volatility and security work here to create a logic of expulsion. In poisonings such as those in Minamata Bay, Japan, Grassy Narrows, Canada, the Love Canal, or many of the other industrial accidents of the 20th century, when monetary compensation is provided to victims of industrial pollutions and disasters, it was to redress a wrong typically carried out through ignorance, negligence, or criminal activity. We may say that compensation was retroactive. It redressed an irreversible past wrong that no one could now do anything to alter. In the Muskrat debate, this language of retroactive compensation began to be used in a new way to justify the future poisoning of a population. An emergency measure from the late industrial era got reworked into the basis for regular public policy. As a model of the state regulation of environmental and manufactured risk, it is deeply disturbing. It means that an industrial or extractive industry can be planned with full knowledge of toxic effects. The promise of future compensation for those to be knowingly injured protects the state and industry from ethical and legal responsibility for the people and things it harms, as it begins to expose the population to harms that are now the condition of completing the project. In this new arrangement of environmental risk and finance, no one is required to do anything to actually reduce the risk of poisoning or to lessen toxic effects. And so the promise of compensation effectively functions as a legal mechanism that allows the local population to be exposed to physical harm as early as 72 hours after flooding. Not to mention that the promise of compensation far into the methylated future would of course depend upon the continued political will to provide it. The Ball government will likely only be in power for another year or two, but the environmental effects of mercury poisoning will last for generations. Without a plan to stop the flooding, any demand from the indigenous self-government could only be recognized if it first accepted the plan to poison the river and see its people as legally injurable, and so legally compensatable. Let me end these thoughts now by thanking the land protectors and the Make Muskrat Right movement who formed such a powerful resistance against the dam on the Churchill River and the long transaction chains that link a whole new wave of exposure of life to harm, that link together a whole new wave of exposures of life to harm, and that reacted against this movement to make the state no longer responsible to protect citizens from the changes in the market of environmental threats. The resistance of Muskrat Falls is an important moment, an important movement, sorry, to reactivate and to re-democratize and to make the subject of public debate and contest what was falsely presented as an apolitical, technocratic inevitability. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve, for those great talks. Just as a little comment, we started 10 minutes late, so we're going to move 10 minutes forward. So those of you who are following the agenda closely, don't worry, we're going to go into our 30-minute dialogue just about 10 minutes, just to make sure that both Steve and Marina have enough time to speak about their important research. So we have about 5-6 minutes for questions for Steve, if anyone has any.
Do you see any hope from Brazil now has implemented a mega dam policy? Brazil
recently implemented an anti-mega-dam policy. So do you see some hope across the world?
I think the thing is that there is concern that dams are not green and that dams are bad technically and all of that kind of thing. And there may well be something to that, that dams produce methane, that they produce methyl mercury, etc. The scale of this dam is certainly a problem. You know, that the fact that there could not be an investigation of any other alternatives meant that there was never an alternative of creating smaller dams, say in Newfoundland, to feed the Newfoundland supply. Initially this began, maybe just solving the problem of the 20% of Newfoundland's consumption in the Avalon Peninsula. There were many ways to do that with smaller dams, etc. So the big dam is a problem on its own. What I wanted to say was that the technical nature of a dam is one kind of a threat. I could imagine that a dam could work in some feasible kind of way. The problem here is really the financial and political chains that make that dam work and then reorganize social life in order to create the financing for it. If it were possible to create better political economy to create a dam, then it might work better. That is, you know, that's separate from the question of the mercury poisoning. Could there be a dam that did not poison the people around it, etc.? But I think an important thing in all of these questions is to separate out the technical problems of the dam from the social and political organization and arrangement. Now, some of the technical problems of the dam, the exposure to harm and all of those kinds of things, those are organized through social and political means, that people are made more or less injurable. Some people are more or less able to be injured, and then whether or not they're able to be compensated, all that kind of thing, those are political and social questions. I don't know if I'm responding to your comment here now, but banning the dam, it's not the technical nature of the dam that is the problem. It is really the political economy of the organization of the dam. If you have not, you should read this great essay by Arundhati Roy. Does anyone know this essay called The Greater Common Good, that is about dams and how dams remade the 20th century, that they were the central device of developing nations from Afghanistan to Ghana to India to Belize, all over. And Arundhati Roy says you would always see the same figures around these dams, the same kind of bankers, investors, technical consultants, all of these other people who were linking the dam into these circuits of financial complexity that nations could never dig themselves out of. So even if the dam could work technically, the finance of it would always sink them. So I think Muskrat Falls, it's that kind of a problem that, well, there is one, the scale of that dam is so enormous that it does make the technical nature of it a problem. But beside that, the political organization and economy of the Muskrat Falls Dam is really the crisis of the Muskrat Falls Dam, I think. Well, everything follows from that, I suppose, is what I have to say.
Chess Rugby, in your scheme of things, I guess your political economy of this dam, I'm just wondering what the role of the federal loan guarantee is, because As you point out, this couldn't have been done without it.
Right.
It amounts to $7.9 billion. So I'm listening to you and thinking that the role of that guarantee was to facilitate the collateralization of the Newfoundland population
right.
for the benefit of international finance. Is that fair?
It's something like that, yeah. I mean, it has another layer of complexity where we are supposed to be...
I'm sure I only use a very few words to describe it. I'm sure you could do better.
Okay, but I'll have a question for you then, Seth. It is, I mean, to bring it back, that I do think that the federal loan guarantee is a really central part of this that has not been discussed enough. It seems to me that the federal loan guarantee is the mechanism that ties electrical rates on the island to the paying of that massive dam and to the need to keep those loan payments going, even in spite of all of the other questions about methylmercury and all of that kind of thing. Now, the loan guarantee is a legal fiction created by the federal government imposed upon this that could be organized in other ways. There is certainly a legal argument to be made, and Chess Crosby, the lawyer, could probably help us with this, that the federal government here has involved us in a loan guarantee that prevents the citizens of the province from fully being able to access energy security, food security, to be citizens in a full and robust way. That it interferes with our constitutional rights in some way to be able to, however a lawyer would finish that sentence, to be able to live and to thrive and to have basic existential security. Is there a way of getting out of the loan guarantee? Do you think that there is any prospect of a political movement that would try to convince the federal government to rescind the loan guarantee, to change it or organize it, so that it wouldn't threaten energy security of the poorer population in Newfoundland? That is a question for you.
Or as Dave Verdi suggested in his last slide, possibly the answer is for the federal government to turn that into equity.
But then, see, the problem is that as long as you don't get rid of this escalation in the rates of electricity, then you're never going to be able to provide energy security for people who, for example, are on a fixed income or unable to change their income as the electrical rate increases. For example, I live in downtown St. John's. Many of my neighbors live in very poorly renovated boarding houses with really bad windows, holes in the walls, all of that kind of stuff. They've got some bad baseboard heater that can only turn up so far because they're on a fixed income. When the electrical rate increases, they will have to turn down the baseboard heater and live a colder future. That will be true as long as you have that financial mechanism that makes the electrical rates pay for the insane costs of Muskrat Falls. So what we really want is a public policy that begins with extending energy security to everybody so that no one's energy security is threatened by the escalating costs of Muskrat Falls. That's what I think that we should do to that's what would be the object of rescinding the loan guarantee. You want me to leave now? Okay.
No, thank you so much, David. Jim, I saw that you put your hand up. But don't worry, we have a 20-minute dialogue session at the end where we're going to ask all our speakers and you can ask more questions and we'll hope to bring more voices in. Because as you can see, as the day continues on, there's more and more rich information coming out. And I think our discussions and questions will continue long after the symposium.